Mr. Freeman, Assistant Attorney General representing the state.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General James Freimuth, representing Petitioner State of Wisconsin. With me this morning at council table is Kenosha County Deputy District Attorney Susan Karaskevich, who is the lead prosecutor in this homicide case. This matter is before the court to review an evidentiary issue arising in the middle of the state's prosecution of defendant Paul Stewart for first-degree intentional homicide. The issue is, should the state be allowed to introduce at trial the preliminary hearing testimony of an unavailable witness, John Stewart, a brother of the defendant, under the former testimony hearsay exception, or would the admission of such former testimony abridge the defendant's constitutional right of confrontation? In three sentences, I'd just like to summarize the procedural posture of this case, because it is unusual. The trial court denied the state's request to admit the former testimony, and the state immediately filed a notice of appeal in the Court of Appeals, followed by a petition for leave to appeal and a request for stay of trial. Acting expeditiously, the Court of Appeals construed the trial court's order as a final order and affirmed it. Last Friday, this court accepted the state's emergency petition for review and ordered a stay of trial. The state asked this court today...
Why is it a final order?
It's a final order because under 97405, sub 1, I believe it's sub 1, sub D 2, it's an order that has the effect of excluding evidence. Under this court's prior decisions, albeit decisions that were in a pretrial context, one was the Supreme Court, I believe, and one was the Court of Appeals, I'm not sure, Moss and Eichmann are the two cases, the test for determining whether or not an evidentiary ruling under the rules of evidence is significant enough to amount to a final order depends on the significance of that evidence. And in this particular case, what the Court of Appeals apparently concluded, although it doesn't explain that, is that this was significant enough evidence to construe it as a final order.
What's significant enough?
The way that was represented by the state to the Court of Appeals is that this is critical testimony without which the state has a difficult time going forward, perhaps, with this prosecution.
Why can't the state go forward with it, and if there's a not guilt, and note the objection, and appeal a not guilty verdict? Go ahead.
As I understand it, the double jeopardy prohibition would preclude the state from appealing a judgment of acquittal. We do have a suggestion, however, that might work in a situation like this down the road. This is a very unusual circumstance. As far as in the collective memories of my more senior colleagues in the department, the state has never done this before, so I don't think there's a fear that this is a commonplace thing that would
occur. But I have a fear that it might become a commonplace.
Well, one answer to this question, the state's in a difficult position because of the attachment of jeopardy, this arising at trial, and we want to protect the double jeopardy interest, are we?
But isn't there a real question as to whether double jeopardy interests do attach to this kind of that there are courts, I understand, there are decisions, I haven't read them, that says that double jeopardy does not attach under these kinds of circumstances.
I'd have to say that I'm not familiar with that. My impression is that double jeopardy would. The solution that we would suggest to the court would be in this situation, where the evidence is through opening statement of the prosecutor and perhaps through other sources, it's clear that this is evidence of a key state witness, that trial courts be encouraged to allow that evidence, that former testimony, in. Let the case go to the jury. That gives the trial court an opportunity thereafter in the context of the entire trial, which is the normal way this gets reviewed when the defendant's appealing. That would give the trial court an opportunity to view this in the entire context of the trial. And then if the trial court decides that the evidence shouldn't have come in or that the defendant was not able to sufficiently challenge it for some reason, the trial court could direct a judgment notwithstanding the verdict. The state could then appeal from that. And if that appeal is successful, the original jury verdict of guilty could be reinstated.
Counsel, what you're suggesting seems to me to say to a trial judge, arguably, look, this is a big case. Allow the error to occur. Let these, if appropriate, 12 jurors find this person guilty of first-degree homicide. And then hope and pray that the judge stands up in his community and says, I'm overturning this conviction of first-degree murder because I made an evidentiary error. That seems to be asking a lot.
Well, I think the predicate here is when that evidentiary issue arises, the significance of that evidence should be, hopefully, be apparent. And that's the predicate to this happening. If this isn't significant evidence, the state may have no cause to be concerned about it. It's just this rare circumstance where that would occur. The trial court could do as it did here, keep it out. But then we're back in this position of what does the state do in order to get review when this happens in the middle of trial. Now, I mean, one possibility that didn't happen here, but I don't think is any better than what has happened, is the state could pursue a mistrial or ask for a mistrial. If the trial court denies the mistrial, we're back in the same position then of having to ask for a quick review, because otherwise it goes to the conclusion of the trial and the state believes that it doesn't have the evidence to convict.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So we get a procedural not only for this case, but for subsequent cases of having intermediate appeals while the jury is still out, right?
Correct.
And one might assume that almost every evidence that the state puts on has some significance, otherwise they wouldn't be putting it on. I realize some is more crucial than others. Okay. Now, let's assume the state prevails. Does the jury hear John Stewart take the fifth?
I'm sorry, I guess I don't understand that.
Okay, so we're going to go back, and you prevail, and we're going to let in the preliminary testimony, right?
Okay.
All right, does John Stewart take the stand? Witness stand? Has he already taken the witness stand? Has he said he's not going to testify?
In this particular, right, the basis for the evidentiary ruling is that he's taking the Fifth Amendment and the court is declaring him unavailable.
Right, and is that done before the jury?
Normally not, but in this particular case, at the defense request, it was actually put before the jury. At least the invocation of the Fifth, not the basis that was talked about outside the presence of the jury.
And what's the basis?
The basis was, and there's a question and answer, one question from the trial court and an answer, which is quoted on page 2 of the defendant's brief. It's also at page 106 of the state's appendix. And just to paraphrase, the trial court asks, when he's invoking the Fifth, asks John Stewart, is the basis for your worry concerning incrimination, concerning the fact that if your testimony is different under oath in this courtroom than it was at the time of the prelim, you would be subjecting yourself to a possible charge of perjury.
So jury didn't hear that?
Jury did not hear that.
Jury only hears he doesn't want to testify.
That's correct. Is it? In this particular case.
Does jury hear that he's gotten immunity?
No, they do not. That's correct.
All right.
Is the jury told that he's invoking his Fifth Amendment rights?
He does so in front of the jury, right. They ask, it's a very, like one or two questions, I believe, at the end of the on the February 10th transcript. I don't have the page number, but I could.
So with that, then, what are you saying? That the defendant then gets an opportunity to argue in closing argument that, hey, he took the Fifth Amendment. What is he arguing? This guy's taken the Fifth Amendment because he was lying before, but he's not lying now. But what's he not lying about? Because he hasn't said anything now.
Generally, there is a statute that the directory that suggests that there should be no comment on the Fifth Amendment. I don't know how this would play out in this particular circumstance where it came in. I do have a suggestion, however, how we could deal with this recantation testimony, but it would be in the context of a remedy that does not relate to the admissibility of the preliminary hearing testimony. It would be apart from that. I can explain that further in the summary of my argument.
Well, this is non-recantation. He has not recanted.
Exactly. We don't know what that means when he says exactly.
He just may have
pleading the Fifth improperly, for all we know.
That's correct.
Okay.
The summary of the state's position very quickly is it would ask this court to hold that the preliminary hearing testimony of the unavailable witness, John Stewart, is presumptively reliable for confrontation clause purposes because it fits within a firmly rooted hearsay exception, the former testimony exception, and that there are no unusual circumstances to warrant exclusion of that former testimony on confrontation clause grounds. One point I'd like to emphasize here that wasn't well... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Why can't the state bring in other evidence? Why aren't there other witnesses to this admission against his brother's interest, or statement against his brother's interest? There were police officers.
There may be alternative avenues for the defendant to get the answer to this unanswered question at the preliminary hearing. But the state's position is that that is not a proper analysis of unusual circumstances. The state's position, and I was going to say that is now, unfortunately, not well distilled in the state's brief, is that unusual circumstances in this context means circumstances which undermined the preliminary hearing protections that render such testimony presumptively reliable. In other words, all those five things, the testimony under oath, with counsel on part of the defense, judicial proceeding has been recorded, and the opportunity for effective cross-examination, if those are present, that's presumptively reliable testimony, and unusual circumstances, as I read the cases, including this court's decision in Abbefeld, Ohio versus Roberts, when they talk about unusual circumstances, they're talking about things like the absence of counsel, incompetent counsel, things that go to the reliability of the preliminary hearing itself, not beyond that.
Opportunity for effective cross-examination is what this case is all about, isn't it?
That's correct.
How are they limited on cross-examination?
There was one, in this particular case, at the preliminary hearing, there was one question posed by defense counsel on cross-examination of this witness, John Stewart, that in which the defense counsel asks, under what circumstances did you, and then I'm paraphrasing the rest of this, talk to the police in June 1998? That met with an objection from the state, first irrelevance, and then it was discovery, and the trial court sustained that objection.
Would that have been a sustainable objection during, if this was trial testimony?
It may have been in the sense that the question was ambiguous and be subject to tie-up,
okay, but
because we don't know what.
But the point, I don't want to play games with you, counsel.
Sure.
The point is that isn't a defense counsel seriously impaired or limited in the type of cross-examination at a preliminary examination as compared to the cross-examination that can be conducted at trial?
There's a difference between the scope of cross at a prelim and the scope at trial, but the case law, including the U.S. Supreme Court, in Ohio versus Roberts, California versus Green, says that doesn't mean that the former testimony, the preliminary hearing testimony, is unreliable. In fact, it's just the opposite presumption. It's presumptively reliable. And the only circumstances, to reiterate, is the unusual circumstance that goes to that preliminary hearing testimony itself. Stated a little differently, even though the preliminary hearing is somewhat more limited than trial, it's still sufficiently reliable to give the jury a satisfactory basis on which to assess the reliability of the witness's testimony for purposes of confrontation.
But haven't we said, I've sat 15 years listening to the state argue to limit the kind of testimony that can come in, the kind of questions that can be asked, and I think we're at the point where credibility of witnesses are not an issue in a preliminary examination, and therefore any question that goes to the credibility of a witness is objectionable.
That's correct. The distinction there is plausibility versus credibility. Which is a tough, subtle distinction, I would guess, anyway, but I think the distinction to be made here is that we're talking about the difference between weight and admissibility. For confrontation clause purposes, the admission of preliminary hearing testimony that meets all these criteria, that is presumptively reliable, that everything that he's entitled to get at the prelim comes in. And then, to the extent that the defendant has not been able to do certain things because of the scope of that, that's just a function of the defendant's ability to do that at trial through other means, whatever that might be.
Well, what other means might a defense counsel use to get in the fact that he couldn't cross-examine at preliminary examination with respect to the credibility, with respect to the circumstances under which this was made, with respect to the promises that may or may not have been given? How does a defense counsel do that in practical terms?
Well, it depends, obviously, on the particular case. There may be a statement made by this witness to a police officer in the context of a present sense or existing state of mind kind of statement. There may be, as the prosecutor was talking about, inducements that somebody on a state representative could put in, anything that deals with things like that. Or here the state was willing to stipulate, for example, as to prior convictions of this witness, the fact that he was being prosecuted at the time he gave his preliminary hearing testimony, giving at least an opportunity for the jury to hear an inference that maybe he had some reason of his own to... It's the distinction here, I think, is between the difference, again, weight and admissibility, but between having an ideal basis for evaluating this unavailable witness's testimony versus a satisfactory basis for doing that.
After that objection was made and sustained, did trial counsel try to ask any more questions on the preliminary?
The defense counsel did then proceed to ask additional questions. It's difficult to know precisely what was going on in the mind of counsel, but as listed in the state's brief, in at least six different respects, defense counsel was able to elicit testimony from this witness that went to issues of his accuracy of perception of what the defendant allegedly was saying to him, the meaning, the sincerity. I can catalog those for you. They're in the brief.
Now, did... I'm sorry, Justice Prosser.
John Stewart, how many times did John Stewart indicate that his brother had admitted committing the murder?
There is information in what I call the second appendix, and the reason I haven't discussed that in the brief was because the information in there wasn't presented expressly to the trial court. If I'm permitted to go beyond what was discussed at the time of the evidentiary ruling, I can tell you what those statements are in those documents are. And I do have copies of that to provide to the court if that's permissible.
Let me try to summarize. I thought I read someplace in here that some sort of statement was made to the police in 1993.
That's correct. That was...
Okay. Some sort of statement was made to the police in early 1998, June, something like that.
Right.
And then there's the preliminary examination test.
There's actually three statements, and I need to correct your first one. It's actually in 1992 that the first statement was volunteered during a traffic stop. The second statement was made to the police in April 21st, 1998. And that's a transcribed statement. And then there's a handwritten statement taken on June 1st, 1998.
Does the defense have all of those?
Those were made available to the defense in discovery, correct.
On page 114 of the record, where I'd never be able to pronounce your name, Karaskiewicz, you were speaking, and you say at one point, we talked about the fact he felt shafted by me personally in a plea bargain. Is the substance of that plea bargain in the record?
It is not in the record. It is not beyond this. Beyond this, even in the documents in the police statements, that is not in the police statements.
Has the state resisted making that information available?
No, it has not. As I understand it, again, this is not in the record through the district attorney's office, that with respect to the April 21st, 1998 statement, the witness, John Stewart, was being prosecuted on some additional charges, and the state had reached an agreement on those charges. Entailed dismissing some of the charges. Thereafter, the defendant thought, well, I'm going to present to the state that I have some information about a homicide and see if I can get a better deal out of this. My understanding is that Nothing, no deal was consummated. And the defendant apparently gave a statement to the police thinking that maybe that would be reflect some cooperation that might be taken in at sentencing. I believe that's my understanding of what happened with that. How that would get before the jury would be through a state representative, I guess, or somebody who would be aware of that.
Who's Mr. Herbst?
Mr. Herbst? Mr. Herbst is defense's investigator. It's tricky with the record being sort of not complete and me not being present at the trial court level. Turning then again to the presumption of reliability, I think this is important. The fact that the scope of cross-examination at a prelim is designed to be more limited than at trial does not mean a defendant has been denied the opportunity for effective cross-examination. And this is the proposition articulated in Bauer and Ohio versus Roberts. As I indicated, in fact, just the opposite presumption applies. When, as here, the former testimony was given under oath in the same matter, the defendant had counsel, proceedings were before a judicial tribunal, the defendant had an opportunity for effective cross-examination within the confines of that proceeding.
Now, there's a great deal of discussion in here about, quote, how this particular county handles its preliminaries, and that I saw that in that the defense counsel felt that they were received a short shrift as far as the scope of their questioning. Having been a trial judge for a number of years, thought that it seemed to be a standard, at least from what I saw, if preliminary examination. Do you think that that is a correct assumption, that they were being limited in their questioning on cross-examination?
No, I do not. My focus, of course, has been on this particular witness, John Stewart. Until I saw the appendix to the defendant's brief, I was not aware of the other factors in the preliminary hearing. But the focus should be on this particular witness whose testimony we wish to get in. And I believe that with that one objection, everything else was certainly within, and even that objection was properly sustained, so he had everything he was entitled to at the preliminary hearing. One way to view why this is not an unusual circumstance is to view the situation. Suppose this question had never been asked by counsel.
Counsel, are you finished answering Justice Wilcox's question?
No, I think he was trying to...
It was kind of part of it.
I want to ask, but I don't want to interrupt, and it wasn't clear.
I'll try to finish this very quickly, if I may. Thank you. One way to see this at work in the present case is to consider the situation where this question had never been asked because it was an improper question. The defense counsel knows I can't ask this at the prelim. Why should, in that situation, this preliminary hearing testimony be any less reliable simply because the defense counsel was doing what was entirely proper? It shouldn't be. And all the Wisconsin cases that deal with this, I'll summarize this very quickly here, they do not delve into whether the defendant was allowed to ask questions that would exceed the scope of the prelim, but only whether the defendant was able to achieve what the preliminary hearing allowed.
As I indicated by my earlier question, I see this case as really boiling down to whether or not there was effective right of confrontation, effective cross-examination. Is that
opportunity for it?
Opportunity. Okay. For. And you agree with that?
That's right. I think if you distill it, that's probably fair.
Yet at a prelim, there's no right to confrontation, is there? It's a statutory animal, and there are cases in my recollection that indicate that there is no right to confrontation.
Constitutional right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe that's correct, but I quite honestly can't say for sure.
So we've got a preliminary hearing where there's no right to confrontation, and the question that we have before me was whether or not they had an adequate opportunity for confrontation at the prelim. Well, it seems like a vicious circle.
Except that I believe if all these trappings are present, and you do, in fact, actually have that opportunity.
Well, do you have the opportunity? Because your questioning is quite limited at a prelim. Judge can say, hey, that's irrelevant. It goes to credibility. And continually say, hey, just all we need here is probable cause, right?
That's correct.
And therefore, a limited cross-examination.
Sure.
This is not discovery.
Sure.
But so where do you get the opportunity for cross-examination of prelim? And this goes back to Justice Babbage and to Justice Bradley. if you have limited opportunity at a prelim to ask questions, and the judge takes a tough line and stops you, where do you have the opportunity?
Sufficient opportunity for purposes of reliability of that testimony, because it provides a satisfactory basis within the confines of that proceeding. And all I can say is the case law does provide for that, and I think reasonably so, because otherwise you'd be providing a reverse presumption that preliminary hearing testimony could never be admitted.
But the judicial bench book itself says the defendant does not have a right to, number two, confront witnesses. That's right in the judicial bench book.
Again, I can just repeat the answer that I gave to Justice Bradley, and that is that if these indicia of reliability are present, the U.S. Supreme Court, even this court, has said that's presumptively reliable unless you only look to unusual circumstances if there's something about those criteria that has not been accomplished in this case. I see my time is up.
Counsel. Mr. Branshaw, representing Paul Stewart.
Thank you. I am in quite a unique situation. I am Bob Branshaw. I'm representing Paul Stewart at the ongoing homicide trial in Kenosha County at this time. It commences again, presumably at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Since this trial started, we started 2 weeks ago. On Wednesday of the first week, it was interrupted for several days as a result of the dual appeal that was taken by the state. They didn't exactly understand how to proceed, so they took both an appeal as a matter of right and an appeal interlocutory. I think, as my brief indicates, I believe this is an intolerable situation from the point of view of the continuity of a trial. When we started our proceedings again on the Monday following the first week, in other words, the second week of trial, it was adjourned for two more days to wait for the Court of Appeals decision. It wasn't stayed, as I think the state's brief indicates. It was adjourned by the court in order to try to not get too confused. On Wednesday of the second week, we recommenced after we got the unanimous three-judge decision affirming Judge Fisher's decision, and that had been accepted as an appeal as a matter of right as opposed to an interlocutory appeal. We then went for two more days until Friday morning when waved in front of me was the court's order, staying proceedings, pending a brief, which I had been prepared. My secretary was there till 2 o'clock Monday morning getting it typed up. I don't know how long I'm going to keep help. believe me, I was there too. And we then had to drive up to Madison. I filed the brief yesterday afternoon about 3 o'clock. And this morning we have our oral argument. Tomorrow morning, testimony commences again.
So how many actual days of trial have you had?
Oh, it depends on what you consider a day of trial. As of the number of days we have actually been in court, probably seven. As to the number of days of testimony, I think it's been five.
5 days. Now, the state suggests a test, which in my notes I labeled, for want of a better term, without which not kind of evidence. Is this the kind of evidence that is without which not? Is the state, if the state doesn't get this in, is the state doomed based upon what has...
The state's got... Excuse me.
Based upon what has proceeded so far, thus far?
The state's got problems. This is a snitch case. Every significant witness is a snitch. Started out with his brother, John. I think this is probably, in a sense, a linchpin of the case. I'm not going to dispute that from our point of view. John, in 1992, when he was being stopped, mumbled something to the police. The police followed up on it. The 90 death had been ruled a suicide. The police looked into what he said. It didn't fit anything. They didn't follow up on it. Nothing more happened until he was charged early in 1998, first-degree sexual assault, kidnapping, four intimidations of a victim, and facing something like 130 years. At the time of the preliminary hearing, at the time of, on April, at one of the appearances in this matter, it was the day of the preliminary hearing, a plea bargain apparently was entered into. There's nothing in any record as to what happened except Ms. Karaskevich's comment on the record that there was no, quote, deal, unquote. But immediately after that plea bargain and plea, there is a long statement taken to him, from him, by Detective Tapp. That same day, that was what re-triggered then the investigation, which got a whole chain gang filled with snitches coming forward from the jail saying, like, during this Packer game, he told me he did it and he'd do it again. And another person said, well, yeah, there was a ricocheted bullet or something, and they never found the gun, but he said he did it. So these other, we have our counter snitches who will come in and testify contrary to what their snitches will testify to. But the testimony or the statement that initiated the investigation was from John Stewart in April of 1998 on a death that had occurred 8 years before in 1990 and was quite clearly from the police investigation determined to be a suicide. He was sitting in his chair, slouched down, one bullet through his chest.
Counsel, I guess what you're saying is that you concede that if the state doesn't get in this statement, they're going to lose.
I think they'll lose anyway. And I'm saying that quite candidly. But that is the issue. The issue is whether a preliminary hearing is of any value whatsoever, because if this court rules that this testimony comes in under these circumstances where there has never been any questioning of Mr. Stewart of what his plea bargain was, we do have, I might indicate, in the transcript.
So you'll be able to ask that at trial.
Not if Mr. John Stewart never testifies, I won't.
Well, can't you bring in a police officer?
Me? Bring in a... I'm sorry.
You're doing it on a subpoena.
Yes, I can subpoena, I suppose, anybody I want. I've got three out-of-state witnesses already. But I don't think from a practical point of view we're going to get anything in. I mean, we already have Ms. Karaskevich, and I'm looking for that right now, indicating... You know, at one point in the record, she indicates there was no deal. But on page 4 of February 10th's transcript, these pages are all confused, on the petition for review file, it's page 153, but it's page 4 of February 10th. I agree with that. I can only tell you when I spoke to Mr. Stewart, he told me that he was shafted by me personally because I was the prosecutor on his case. And by the way, Judge Fisher, who made this ruling, was also the judge in his case. So he certainly was able to judge Mr. John Stewart in an earlier case. He stated his belief that when I came into court and recommended probation, belief was that I was to come into court and recommend probation, and you as a sitting judge in the case, when in fact, and Mr. Mason would testify to this, the agreement that was reached with Mr. Stewart was before he offered anything to the state. Well, at the end of that paragraph, the last sentence is, Mr. Mason would also testify to that he did not get anything else from me, and the misunderstanding apparently is between Mr. Mason and Mr. Stewart. So not only do we have no information from Mr. John Stewart as to what the so-called agreement is, we have a concession by the district attorney that there must have been a misunderstanding. I don't know how, other than calling the prosecuting attorney, we get that information as to the misunderstanding. And if I could just complete my train of thought, that is that it doesn't matter what Mr. Mason says, it doesn't matter what Ms. Karaskevich says, it doesn't matter what any police officer says, the motivation for the testimony that needs to be tested is Mr. John Stewart. It's what his understanding was. That is really the only crucial issue here is whether there's been cross-examination that has been effective and confrontation in a classical constitutional sense. Yes,
sir? Well, understanding this is an ongoing trial and getting some of the background from you, but the question here before us is the indicia of reliability and the presumption that when and if there is the indicia, that this would be an exception to the hearsay rule. And I asked the opposing counsel about, and I understand in preliminary, and there was some question about whether or not this was a sufficient or usual preliminary examination. Where do you think, you're saying, as I understand it, is that based on the objection to the question which you just went in about the plea bargain, that this shows that there was not an indicia of reliability, or was the entire process in some way short-circuited where there was not sufficient cross-examination?
In response, can I read part of a paragraph from Judge Fisher's determination and his comments at the time of the decision that he made? And this is on page 22 of the February 11th transcript. Again, that's page 126 on the petition for review, where I think that's the only place I think where the entire sets of transcripts are contained. Now the court also has to take into consideration reality. And it is not Mr. Jambois that made the rules, and it is not Kenosha County that limits cross-examination at a preliminary hearing. There has been, and there is, an ongoing argument in regard to whether preliminary hearings are, should even be continued under the manner in which they are now restricted, or whether or not we should just give up preliminary hearings. And that argument is going on in regard to the reformation of the criminal code. Skipping a little bit here. I don't know what will happen there, but what it points out is simply that it is statewide, it is the law of the state, that there is a restriction on preliminary hearings. They are to be summary proceedings, and unless the state doesn't object, they generally are summary proceedings. Given the nature of this case and having read the transcript from the preliminary hearing, it's the court's opinion, then he goes on to say that he doesn't think that under the circumstances there was any effectiveness to the cross-examination because of those restrictions. I have added to my brief the rest of the preliminary hearing, and I think that gives an indication when a couple other witnesses are being examined as to the extent to which the state will go to limit us when we get into discovery, when we get into credibility, when we get into veracity. We're just cut off completely if we bring any questions like that in. It's the red one, Judge, and it's... Yeah.
No, but I'm looking at the blue one because that's the opposite,
that's the opposite
of the red one. And the reason I'm looking at the blue one is because the state challenges that observation by Judge Fisher. In other words, they felt that he had misstated, or they felt that his understanding of the law was incorrect as far as the indicia of reliability and whether or not preliminary examination testimony could be used. That's all I wanted to... That's why I'm using the blue one rather than the red one.
Thank you.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
Well, you were the attorney at the preliminary examination?
No.
Okay.
I was appointed in mid-course, and I did mention that in my brief. There is, in California versus Green, that's mentioned. He's deceased. He can't testify.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that. He died.
He passed away, unfortunately. Gary
Sumter. If you had been the attorney in that preliminary examination, what questions would you have wanted to ask that you believe the present law forbid you to ask?
What charges were you facing? What conversations have you had with the district attorney? Where did you get your information? Why did you provide the information in 1992? What motivated you to do that? What deal do you think you got? What do you think is going to happen to you at the time of sentencing? All these issues are the key motivating factors which causes a snitch or anybody else to come forward. They want a benefit. If that benefit can't be tested, if that benefit can't be explained to the jury in reasonable detail, there is no cross-examination. We have a man who stood up in front of Judge Fisher, and that's why I think the Court of Appeals, and this court also, does not really, under its own rules with respect to making independent determinations, I think there should be deference shown to Judge Fisher's ruling. He knew John Stewart. He had him testify under oath with respect to his taking the Fifth Amendment. John Stewart said it was his concern that if I testify today, I am going to be charged, potentially charged with perjury, because my testimony will be different than it was at the preliminary hearing. There are no indicia of reliability under those circumstances. It can't possibly exist. And to take the preliminary hearing transcript out of context with the kinds of restrictions that would be placed thus on us to get anything in front of the jury contradicting it is it's a frightening thought from my point of view. And I think if this case actually does determine that John Stewart's testimony can come in under these circumstances, I think you will be effectively ending preliminary hearings in Wisconsin, because I would never go to a preliminary hearing under the kinds of restrictions I have to go under with respect to the scope of the examination. I would waive it. If John Stewart had never, if Erie Sumter had waived that preliminary hearing, there would be no such testimony that could be even threatened to be used. Thank you.
Who is our first?
He's my investigator. And he's been working with me, and he sat with me at the counsel table during the part of the trial that's occurred so far.
Did Mr. Herbst meet with John Stewart prior to the trial?
Yes, on Sunday afternoon, before the Monday the trial was going to start, Mr. Herbst and I went up to see John Stewart, who had been brought back from prison. I stayed about a half an hour to 40 minutes. Mr. Herbst stayed a couple more hours talking to him. We're in a situation where while I was there, Ms. Karaskevich came in. And that's one of the things I'd like to object to in the state's brief, if I can get that in while I'm answering you. Because there seems to be an implication in the state's brief that this came as a surprise in the middle of trial. Ms. Karaskevich had seen John Stewart. She came in Sunday afternoon to see him. I was there. She left Monday morning before the trial. She went up to see him. He indicated to her at that point that he wanted a lawyer. Now, I don't know. I don't want to probe anybody else's mind and try to come to conclusions as to what they should think. But if I was a prosecutor and my witness, who I considered important, told that to me the morning before the trial started, I guess I would try to take some action at that point.
Are you suggesting that the district attorney knew that John was going to take the Fifth Amendment?
No, that's why I can't read her mind. I do know she knew that there was a problem, though, because she called Chuck Bennett of the public defender's office and tried to arrange immediate counsel to be appointed. They indicated that they couldn't. Because there was a conflict, and Duck Henderson was appointed by the court, I think, later that day.
Now, I want to...
So you're saying that she should not have started the trial, is that...
Well, I say that only based on what the appellate counsel has said at this point with reference to the total fact situation. I don't want to second-guess what she did the morning of the trial.
I just want to...
I'm sorry, I interrupted Justice Brown.
I might just ask this. This might be unfair, but I look at page 107 of the record, and I see a question by the district attorney. Now, Mr. Stewart, do you, in the course of making your decision about whether or not to testify in this case, have you met with Mr. Art Herbst? And the answer is, yes, sir, I have.
He was in the course, I'm sure that's true. And he had to say that because he met with Art Herbst the day before. That's not true. It was the Sunday, and I think this was occurring on a Wednesday. So, yes, he had talked to me and to Art Herbst. And also, if you look in the record, we explained that meeting.
Now, why shouldn't I draw the inference that the idea for John Stewart not to testify may have come out of that meeting, and that, in fact, You're now trying to take advantage of that.
The reason you shouldn't draw it is because it's not true. And when we walked in to see John Stewart, I asked him whether he was going to testify, what was going to happen, and he indicated to me that he wasn't sure, he wanted to talk to a lawyer. That's what happened. The conversation continued. and there were questions asked and answered, but that already was in his mind. He wanted a lawyer, and he wasn't sure whether he was going to testify. That existed as of the time that Sunday, the day before the trial, about contemporaneous with Ms. Gariskevich is coming up and seeing us together in the jail cell. I have already, on the record, you may have noted, been accused of being involved in a conspiracy to... I guess that's going to, of course, if anything comes of that, it will certainly inhibit defense counsel's right to talk to witnesses if they're afraid that they're going to get accused of a conspiracy every time they go out and talk to one of the state's witnesses. But I'm presenting to you my understanding of the initial contacts that Mr. Herbst and I had together in that case, and Mr. Stewart had already indicated he may not be willing to testify, and was asking me whether there should be a lawyer, whether you should have a lawyer, and I said, under these circumstances, I couldn't possibly not recommend a lawyer for somebody. Yes, I think you should have one.
If this court were to authorize the admission of the testimony from the preliminary examination, what remedies would you like to have to prepare to impeach that?
I couldn't possibly. I think I would be in a position, if I answered that question, to abrogate every belief I have on what the right of confrontation and cross-examination is all about. Because there has been no... See, what you're doing is you're saying, is there a way we can kind of peripherally bring in the information to present to the jury through either other witnesses or other information that somehow will make up for the fact that a fundamental constitutional right is being denied. Forgive me, sir, but I really don't even want to get into that area. I will leave that to the Attorney General to propose to you. I think I would be basically in a situation where I don't think I'd be able to effectively do it from a practical point of view, because this is his brother. This is this man's brother. And this is a real difficult thing from the point of view of trying to indirectly explain.
The first counsel, who's now deceased, had been able to get an answer to the question that he asked, and maybe asked a couple of other questions about what happened and had determined the nature of any inducements for testimony, would you be objecting to the admissibility of the prelim testimony then?
Well, as a practical matter, I probably would be, but I would probably lose. If there was a real cross-examination on these issues that are so crucial, and that with respect to veracity, credibility, and the nature of the his understanding of what the deal was. Yeah, I'd object, if that's what your question is, but I think I'd have a much more difficult road to hoe with respect to explaining my position and prevailing.
Do you think confrontation as a constitutional right are due to the defendant at a preliminary?
I think that cases up, and it's not an area I've researched. I'm speaking now as a trial lawyer and not as a constitutional law expert by any means. I do some appeals, but they tend not to get to this court. I think that we would be creating a difficult situation if we created that right to confrontation at a preliminary hearing. I don't dispute the purposes of preliminary hearing. I love to be able to try to use it as discovery. I love to be able to try to use it to confront the witnesses there. I have been to the point where I've been threatened with being shut down by the magistrate because I'm asking too many questions in that line. I have also told them as we've left preliminary hearings that someday this is going to come back to bite you. You're not letting this information in. You're going to someday want... I think Mr. Jambois may remember those comments I've made to him. You're going to want to use this sometime for an unavailable witness, and it's going to hurt you. Well, they just keep going on objecting because they're playing the percentages. They win more than they lose. I think it would be difficult. It would prolong the preliminary hearings considerably. It would create a lot more appeals with respect to the objections that would be sustained or... From a practical point of view, I think it would be a real difficult right to implement. But that then has to have its consequences. And those consequences mean there has been no confrontation, and the cross-examination will be extremely limited to those areas relating to probable cause. And I hear it over and over again, objection sustained, objection sustained, objection sustained. This is discovery, this is credibility, this is veracity, it's not plausibility. You can't get into it, Mr. Brancher, and you better stop right now. The issues of indicia or reliability clearly don't fit here. This is not the classic case where you have a witness who recanted, a witness who has just moved away and disappeared, a witness who is a co-defendant, a witness... This is a unique set of circumstances here. A man facing 135 years comes in, or approximately 135 years, comes in, some kind of deal is struck, there's a plea bargain, immediately after that takes place on April 21st, there's a long statement that he gives. And then he comes out of the sentencing saying, I got shafted. I don't think you're going to run into one like this again, and I'm surprised it's here right now based on my own views of the role of this court. I've run to seminars, I'm told over and over again this is not an error-correcting court. That's why I really, after feeling really sorry for myself last Friday after I got your order, I sat and thought about why. What law might you want to change? And that's why I put the first item on the brief, the issue of whether or not to proceed, what procedure should be used to try to raise this kind of issue. And I firmly believe that the state law should be interpreted in such a way that only an interlocutory appeal can be handled, can be brought from an ongoing trial. To allow this as a matter of right is going to create a situation where the state, anytime it gets itself in a jam, in a case, can take some evidentiary ruling up as a matter of right and claim, well, we're not being allowed to get this in, therefore we want an appeal. And there's supposed to be some protection through the Attorney General's office, but as a defense attorney, I don't credit that with too much value, with all due respect to counsel. I guess I'm getting a warning at this point. If there are any other questions, I have to go to my last second.
Justice Babbitt has a question.
Okay, review for me the difference between an interlocutory appeal and what is here in this case.
Please ask me a slightly different question. That is, what is my understanding of the difference between an interlocutory appeal and why we're here today? As I understand it, there are two statutes, and I mentioned them in my... I don't have them memorized. I mentioned them in my brief. One, basically, is a statute as a matter of right, and one of those subsections, as I remember it, says that jeopardy cannot have attached. This subsection, I believe, stands alone with respect to appealing an evidentiary denial of, or suppression, I guess they call it, of evidence. And that is, as I understand it, how we're here today. When the state appealed, they appealed under both subsections. One would be a permissive appeal. The other would be an appeal as a matter of right, which... I construe the permissive one to be the interlocutory appeal, where the appellate court can say, no, we're rejecting your appeal and we're not going to hear it. This was accepted as a matter of right under that 970 whatever, and they chose to accept that because I believe of that subsection that says that the state does have a right to proceed as a matter of right when evidence is not allowed in. I understand what that says, but I think that it creates the potential for a horrible burden on trial attorneys. And I believe that it should be interpreted to include that issue of not allowing it to happen after jeopardy attaches. 974.05 on page 3 of my brief. The red one this time. That's usually the blue one. Within the time period specified, may appeal from any order, the substantive effect of which results in the suppressing of evidence. And I'm sure the reason for that is because the rationale behind it was that the state, if it does go to a jury verdict, cannot appeal. At least that's I think, the traditional interpretation. So there has to be a way of reviewing it. But I don't see why it can't be reviewed on an interlocutory basis to allow the court, well, trial court, to continue until the court, appellate court believes that there is something substantive enough to justify a stay.
Now, here, as I understand the procedural posture, the state filed a notice of appeal under 974, which is the they have a right to appeal.
Both. They have filed under both.
I know, that was, and the next one is, but then a couple days later, they filed a petition for leave to appeal. And that's the interlocutory appeal.
That's my understanding. I certainly would not want to lecture this court on interpretations of those rules. I've never dealt with them before.
Well, what's the difference? What if we treated it as an interlocutory appeal?
Well, the difference then would be that the Court of Appeals would have the right to make an independent determination as to whether they should hear it. And that would provide at least some kind of protection to the trial judge, the defense attorney. I mean, this isn't just a matter of us arguing some obscure procedural or evidentiary issues. This gets to fundamental right to effective assistance of counsel. If I'm being called up to Madison in the middle of a trial, it isn't doing any good for my client. Hopefully it won't hurt him too badly, but it isn't helping him.
Counsel.
Yes, ma'am.
Whether it was an interlocutory appeal or it was an appeal of right, under either circumstances, your coming here was on leave of this court.
I understand that.
Okay. Now, if you're asking us to decide the procedural issue for the Court of Appeals purposes of whether this is validly before them as a matter of right, that issue is, I remember the briefs, and I try to get back through it. You briefed it somewhat, but the state did not, if I remember that. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think the state mentioned it, but I don't think they really briefed it as such.
Okay, we can ask the state. We can look at the briefs. Are there any other questions?
I have a red light.
Right.
Got to stop.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Okay. You may stop now. Good.
Get back to that.
Well, what's the issue before us? The substantive issue, or this procedural issue, or neither, or both?
I would suggest at this point that it's the substantive issue, the evidentiary issue. I'm prepared to discuss procedure, and in that context, just to follow up on the last discussion, all I can represent is that in the collective memories of the people in our office, that this is an unusual situation, that this is not something we anticipate happening very often.
But should this come up to us in the form of an interlocutory appeal or an appeal of right?
That's a tough question. That's where the case law, the test for whether it's a significant enough issue is the linchpin at the moment. It could come in as, if you did it as interlocutory, the difference as I see it is, if you did it as interlocutory, if you construed it as a non-final order, in part because it's in the middle of the trial, then the Court of Appeals could be the last repository, in that if they denied the petition for leave to appeal, we don't have an automatic right to, or we cannot appeal that. At least this court hasn't quite closed the door on that, as I understand it, but almost has. If it was really extraordinary, we obviously would pursue that then. But there would be some review, at least at that point. But it still doesn't answer the question of how quick the review comes in that situation. And that's why this rule that we suggested about some consideration from the trial court to getting it in to allow a full review, to allow a full record to develop.
See, all I have is an intuition right now. My intuition tells me that if we treat this as a matter of right, that we could see a floodgate coming in. Is my intuition unfounded?
All I can tell you is that based on past experience, this is a unique situation.
So. Right, but now if we give it to you as a matter of right rather than as an interlocutory appeal, don't you think a lot of district attorneys in the state are going to be knocking on your door?
Well, if they have to pass through us, I guess we have to, there's a certain screening from our office, but it could be treated as an interlocutory. I'm not suggesting that that isn't proper. Excuse me.
This is a matter of Court of Appeals process, not this court. Isn't that right?
Some level of review is what we are asking for from
that Court of Appeals.
It could be through the interlocutory, which could be the end of it. It could be as it was done here. The problem we have is because this arises in the middle of a trial where jeopardy is attached, we don't have any good recourse for immediate review. Our case could be sabotaged And I'm not suggesting here that it, you know, but it could be sabotaged under circumstances like this, and we don't have any recourse for review.
Tell me where you briefed this procedural issue.
The non-final versus final order, that was in our petition for leave to appeal that it was discussed. And once we got here, I didn't pursue that in the brief. A couple of points in response to Justice Prosser's questions. First, my understanding from the district attorney is that there was no advance knowledge here that this witness was going to take the Fifth Amendment prior to trial. There was discussions with, between the investigator and the witness, but to the state's knowledge, nothing was represented that I'm going to take the Fifth Amendment so that the state could do this pretrial and avoid this issue of jeopardy attaching. With respect to the issue of the defendant's ability to attack motive, credibility, I think it's important to remember here the first step is you don't get there because you don't have unusual circumstances in this preliminary hearing. Everything that, all the trappings of that hearing are present. And for this court to say that you look beyond that, I think would be either contrary to the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, or it would be an extension. But if you were to look at unusual circumstances in this case, there are means by which the defense could present to the jury evidence testing the credibility of this witness. One thing that's in our second appendix that was not provided to the court that's directly relevant to this unanswered question at the prelim is that on June 1st, 1998, the witness, John Stewart, was concerned about this Illinois burglary. The Illinois burglary was the burglary at which the suspected weapon used to shoot Gary Regals was stolen, and that John Stewart and his brother, the defendant, were involved in that burglary. In a discussion with the district attorney and Illinois authorities, it was promised to this witness that he would not be prosecuted in Illinois as long as he was not involved in this homicide. And that information is in the second appendix, and I'd be happy to distribute it to the court. I don't know what the court's position is as far as expanding the record, but adding to the record based on what we know. I see my time's up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. This ends our oral arguments for today. We will be in session on Thursday for a further